Welcome to the MacGuffin Man, a podcast for the common man. I'm Alex, and with me, as always, is James. Yep, good sound.
I'm the Charlie in this scenario, I think.
I guess that breakdown makes sense.
I know it's not great, but...
It's still better than our Irishman breakdown. But, yeah, anyway, let's just get right into it. We're talking about Barton Fink today.
Yes, we are.
Yes, Coen Brothers film. 1991?
Yeah, and this was their... They were having a hard time writing Miller's Crossing. Is that right?
Yes, yeah. And they ended up making Miller's Crossing before this. Like, they went into production on this after they finished Miller's Crossing, is my recollection.
Yeah, and it's a movie... it's about a lot of things. I guess you could say it's about writer's block in a way, but there's... there's a lot going on in here, and reading about this movie and the way the Coens talk about their films in general, they're pretty open about the fact that, at least with some of their movies, you could read into it in a lot of ways, and I don't know if they downplay their role in the symbolism, but from what I read recently about this, it's they see a lot of the things that people point to for their readings and say, yeah, that's fine, but that's not what we did, and we don't come at these movies with that kind of intellectual framework. We do have a lot of things that are left open to interpretation and things that feel right. And I say all of that just as a way of saying there is a lot you can read into this, and there's it's pretty thick if you go looking for it in this movie.
Yeah, absolutely. And I chuckled a little bit when you were describing how the Coens react to people finding meaning in their films, because they're so steadfast about... I believe I read a quote where Joel or Ethan was talking about how critics have been trained to watch movies like that, and they're like zoo animals, and we were teasing them with this movie, which yeah. is hysterical and very Coen Brothers. And as a zoo animal who has spent a lot of time analyzing others of their works, like, I mean, just listen to the Hail Caesar podcast. I feel like I went pretty deep on that one. And A Serious Man, which again is another movie I feel falls in with one of the Coen Brothers' go-to types of films. But yeah, I think I kind of feel like the part of this movie where they are speaking most directly is when they're when it's Mayhew talking about how he just likes telling stories. I kind of get the feeling that's kind of where the Coen Brothers come from for the most part. And because every time I feel like I am reading about how they make movies, they write their movies incredibly fast. Or not necessarily incredibly fast, but fast, you know? And that tends to result in, again, from an outsider, my guess would be these are things that have been, like, inside of them, like, they've been reading things all throughout the years that have sort of built you as a human to a place where you are able to write something that sort of comes out in this form with some symbolism that can be read into as much or as little as you want. And it also just sort of speaks to their willingness to want an audience to be not necessarily confused by their movies, because I think all of their movies are very entertaining in their own right, whether or not you want to read into them. But they want to give the people who want something to think about, there's something there, because they kind of like toying with those things. But they also don't feel the need to have a reasoning behind everything. And I do believe them when they say we don't mean all of these things to be symbolic. Sometimes we just wanted to just to throw something in there just to be a bit more confusing about it, you know?
Yeah, and it I just find it interesting because they're obviously very smart, talented people, you know? They're very
100%
like good at their jobs.
Some of the greatest filmmakers that have ever existed. Yeah,
and so I only bring that up to say it's not like, you know, they just mix a bunch of things up in a hat and pull it out. But I think you're right in the sense that they internalize a lot of other works and are smart enough in their consumption of things that when they create something of their own, it does kind of have the form of something that could, you know, you can find a distinct reading of that has a lot to support it within the text.
Yeah, I agree. And I say that as something that I firmly believe that happens with all writers, all, like, artists in any capacity. Like, a lot of the things that I mean, specifically that we have said on these podcasts about movies that are being made aren't necessarily specifically intended from the movies, but I think they come through the artist and the work that they make. And a big difference between the Coen brothers and a lot of other people is that either other filmmakers just don't talk about these things at all, or they lean into the idea that, yes, I am the all-seeing genius and I planned all of these things. Hitchcock was the king of leaning into it, I think, is the best example. And the Coen brothers are just actively saying, no, we don't mean these things, which is a unique perspective in the world of responding to filmmaking-based questions. And yeah, we love them for it.
Yeah, and so, I mean, and that's not to say that there aren't... kind of undeniable themes in this. You know, we have this idea of the common man, we have a distinction between high culture and low culture, and you know, some of these things are stated pretty you know, explicitly. And I think those two and Barton Fink, the character trying to find a way to support the proletariat in some of his kind of more leftist ideas, or left-leaning at least ideas, as he moves from Broadway to Hollywood, mm-hmm. is one that you can't avoid. Now you can plug into it how maybe what the Coen brothers think of this character, or you know, people with these ambitions. But that seems to be sort of the central beam of this that you can't really get around without, you know, denying what's right in front of you.
No, I 100% agree with that. I think like that's a good helpful exercise, is to sort of say that yes, of course, that's something that was totally intended and is absolutely the backbone of the story. And then I think a lot of the fascism stuff is where the Coen brothers are fucking with us and just sort of throwing it in so you can read more if you want. And there's plenty to be read into it if you want to. But I do think, like, yeah, that was a good idea to sort of explain what we're saying with specific examples from this movie. Very creative idea, and I appreciated it. But no, yeah, that is absolutely the backbone running through this movie, is the person making art, quote unquote, for the common man, or just the person making art.
Yeah, and so if we look at this as sort of where they are making Miller's Crossing, maybe they are you're taking a step back from that, and I don't know, this feels like such, it does feel self-reflective in the way that you know, it's about someone trying to write a movie, and that's kind of just as step one most self-reflexive kind of screenwriting you can do, is screenwriting about screenwriting. And mm-hmm. So it's hard to not look at this as somewhat autobiographical, even though, you know, you're off by 50 years and you know, all the things that come with that, much of a time difference, and Hollywood being a different place despite all the contemporary similarities you could make.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And especially, like, given where the Coen brothers start from, like, making a small independent movie in Texas, you know? So, with Blood Simple being their first film.
Right. You know,
it's not theater in New York, but, you know, they're certainly, they've been moving on up in their career. It's not like Miller's Crossing is a low, I don't know what the budget of Miller's Crossing was, but it was not, couldn't possibly have been a low budget film, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah. And I think, like, again, more of my research, they've denied all of this because they've said that they had a really easy time, working their way into Hollywood. And, I kind of believe that, and that they just sort of have this interesting voice that it feels like people enjoyed hearing. But as far as the dealings with Hollywood that Barton goes through, basically every scene with Michael Lerner in this movie is incredible. Like, I think it's one of the things that we could say for the Coens in general, and probably something we've said on every podcast we've done about them, is that their ability to make the smallest parts so entertaining. And Michael Lerner deserves credit for his performance, but it does seem like the Coens consistently elevate people's performances in a way that you don't see them in other movies. I think even smaller roles, not necessarily in this movie, but other Coen brothers movies. Like, I'm thinking of in No Country for Old Men, the woman who is sort of runs the trailer park is a perfect example. Like, a woman I've never seen in anything else, and is so funny in this Coen brothers movie. And I think you add to that sort of direction, you add somebody like Michael Lerner, who is a talented actor in his own right and has been in so many movies, but being in a Coen Brothers movie turns him into like Al Pacino and Glengarry Glen Ross. He's so goddamn entertaining, you know. And I think that that's sort of like the their ability to, for lack of a better term, coach some actors up in supporting roles, I think is just always so entertaining. And these people always have this performance inside of them, and then just something about either the way that the Coens write or the way that the Coens direct people on set, it just sort of brings out the most unique version of them, I guess, is a good way to describe it. And Tony Shalhoub is the other example in this movie where, like, everybody likes Tony Shalhoub. He's good in everything. But in this, it's just, like, it's a whole nother level of the Shalhoub. And it's fantastic, you know?
Yeah, and I guess I just want to point out that it's not as... It's weird because it is such a dark movie in some ways, and then it's so light in other ways, which we know the Coens do. Mm-hmm. But even just this idea of when you think of a movie like, you know, one with the synopsis of the screenwriter tries to come to Hollywood and is kind of worn down by the system, that's not really the form that this takes. Like, this doesn't proceed that way, even though it really does kind of fit that mold. Mm-hmm. I just don't think Barton Fink... the movie is what you'd expect from that synopsis.
No, that's true. That is true. And it's sort of, I mean, I guess we're kind of talking about the ending at the beginning, but like the idea that the finished movie that he writes, at least what we are able to glean from what the movie gives us, what Barton Fink, the movie gives us about Barton Fink's screenplay at the end, it's very similar to the play that we were hearing at the beginning. And now it's just sort of the parts around it have changed, as opposed to getting this crushing wave of applause that he gets in New York. Now he's just being reminded that he's a stooge working in the studio, and he can write something like this, but he has less control over it now. And I think that's more what the movie's about, is that, like, there's a lot of again, another theme in Coen Brothers movies is just repetition in general, and something at the beginning happening again at the ending, and it's just being the way that it happens is different. And I see that a lot in this movie. And yes, you are right, it, like, the synopsis isn't what you would anticipate, but it's sort of more how your ideas, you put them in a different environment, and the way that they're responded to can be totally different.
Yeah. And I think it's important to point out the fact that, and part of what I mean when it's not that kind of struggle that you'd anticipate, is that Barton Fink largely just gets in his own way for a lot of this. And I don't mean that in the sense that he has these ideals that slowly get chipped away at by the machine, which I think is what you kind of come to expect. He's this left-leaning playwright who is always talking about the common man, and then we get interactions between him and Charlie, who we see as kind of our most common man.
He's an insurance salesman.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, we talk about death of a salesman, you know, something close to this playwright's life. You would imagine he might be able to see that in it. But that's we come to learn that he is not the common man, or, you know, we can talk about that later. Yeah. We get deeper on Charlie.
We'll talk about that in a portion that I'm afraid we might end up having to edit out of the podcast if we don't explain well.
He's getting in his own way in the sense that he can't follow who he claims he is, or who he claims he wants to be, or what he wants his art to look like, and who he wants it to represent. Mm-hmm. And I think that's kind of the distinction I wanted to make between this being kind of the artist versus the machine, and why I don't think the Coen brothers are saying, you know, we're Barton Fink fighting the good fight against mm-hmm. the system. That really doesn't seem to be their goal at all. And we have a protagonist who we really don't fully get behind for large sections of this movie, right?
No, exactly. And I realize, like, the way that I've been describing this movie, it kind of makes me feel like, or makes it sound like I feel like Barton Fink falls in line with a hero of this movie, which I absolutely do not. I think if we're taking anything from this movie, it's that the Coens are more making fun of people like Barton Fink than identifying with them. You know, I'm sure there's a little bit of self-identification in there that they then are making fun of, you know what I mean? And because they can see elements of themselves in that, but not necessarily the whole the whole thing. But yeah, no, I don't think Barton Fink is a likable character at all. And I think pretty early on, he's sort of established as somebody who is, I mean, it's hard not to like John Turturro because he's great in everything. And he's, I don't know, he's John Turturro. That's the only way to say it. And, but yeah. Like very early on, like we have him after the, after he gets the standing ovation for his play, and he's walking in to meet the people who he's got dinner or drink plans with, and
the producers, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. He's listening to one of them read the review from the Herald to the other two, and he's watching the other two listen to the review of his work, and you could just sort of like he's downplaying how little the review actually matters. Like they'll be wrapping it in fish tomorrow, or using it to wrap fish tomorrow, so it's not totally useless, is something he says. But he, you know, he very much cares about how people are reacting to this, and I think the Coens do a really good job of showing that. And then I think they double down on this by in the next part of this scene when he goes to talk to his agent at the bar right before he goes to LA, is the agent saying, "Have you read the Herald?" Barton very eagerly responding by saying, "No, what did it say? Like, we just heard him hear what's in the Herald," you know? And I think that's sort of, that really paints Barton as somebody that, if you like, that's a reflection of some shitty things about you, you know? And I think that's before, like, the 8-minute mark of the movie. I think he goes to Hollywood in the 8-minute mark or so. So it's just, like, pretty early on, we've established that maybe Barton isn't somebody that we would describe as like a good human or somebody without problems. Yeah,
and he's not an anti-hero. You know, I don't think we are being told that he's a really awful person, but I think that's what I like so much about that is that, yeah, we see him asked to kind of hear that review again that we know he just, you know, rolled his eyes through and pretended he didn't want to hear it, but to the point that he wants to hear it again. And even before that, when just the very, very opening, when we see him listening to his play, it's his voice reading the lines, you know?
Yeah. I wanted to ask you about that. That is John Turturro, right?
Yeah. Okay. I can only see that as it's, he sees this so fundamentally as his work that the actors don't even literally have a voice. Like they're just tools to perform his work. And, yeah. You know, in a sense that is true. That's what an actor does. But I don't think an actor would like that. You know, they also do a lot of work to bring their part to it and perform it in a certain way that's not on the page. You know, I just see that as the most, you know, solipsistic, self-centered version of Barton Fink, as the actors have very little to do with the play. It has the playwright, he's God, and later on we see his words show up in the Bible. You know, we see this idea of the writer, the screenwriter, the playwright as just so overwhelming and powerful. And I think that is a way that we quickly get put on the side to not fully trust him. And especially a movie like this where, you know, we have a central character, we're going to a new place that the character's learning, you know, he's this character is so typically meant to be our avatar in the way that we see the world, but you see these moves that they make to really distance you from it, and you're gonna you do see most of this movie through his eyes. You know, Barton Fink's not in a lot of this, or, you know, there's not much of this movie that he's not in and that we're not experiencing with him.
I was going to say, is there a scene in this movie that he's not in?
Like the waves hitting the rock. To think he's like, I'm going to okay. I think he's the waves.
Yeah. No, I'm pretty sure he's the rock. No,
there's just not a ton without him.
And yeah, so it's very like noir that way. Like Jack Nicholson in every scene in Chinatown sort of thing. Like that was a noir staple. And yes, that I can't think of a scene that Barton is not in this movie.
Yeah. And I do love that they play with that idea that he's powerful in all these ways, or he sees himself as powerful in all these ways. And even in the filmmaking language where he gets to be off screen with his mouth closed, but simultaneously listening to himself perform his own work, it does kind of bleed into the form of the story. Mm-hmm. But it definitely, you know, we don't just buy in completely. And the movie also does a lot of things to sell him out, to show him that he's not this all powerful creature and that he's definitely not a benevolent god if he is a god.
Yeah, for sure. And I think if we're just talking about moments that make Barton Fink come off as unlikable, of which there are many, I think the most notable one is when he has just met Charlie, and Charlie's John Goodman's character, and they're talking about how he wants to write theater for the common man and all of these things, and Charlie says, I could tell you some stories, and this happens multiple times, and Barton each time says, I'm sure you could, you know, and just immediately continues saying what he was saying, you know. And I think I love that. I think that's one, it's funny, like it's a good laugh, it gets funny, or makes me laugh every time. And two, I think it really drives home the main point of this idea, the we are suspecting intended point of this movie, that that Barton is kind of a self-absorbed asshole, and he can say that he wants to tell the stories of the common person, but he's not even going to listen to the stories of the common person, you know. And I think listening is another theme of this movie that certainly is intended and gets hit pretty hard by the end of it. But yeah, I think that's really worth pointing out as far as Barton not being the best dude in the world.
Yeah, and I think that it's, I mean, this movie also has some things to say about Hollywood and commerce and, you know, making money versus telling a powerful story. But isn't Hollywood the theater of the common man? Isn't this the way to reach the most people and not just people who can afford a ticket and live in New York City? This is his chance to do something to reach a very wide audience. And
that's true. Does he say he wants to reach a wide audience, though? I think because he's talking about living theater is a big thing that, I guess, movies are also kind of living theater, that they continue to live in the same form over and over again. But I'm not saying I disagree with you. I'm just saying I think living theater is something that's so seemingly aggressively impossible to me that it needs to be pointed out as well. Yeah.
Oh yeah, no problem. I don't disagree with that, but I think whenever he speaks to Charlie and, you know, wants to speak in your language, well, to put it in your language, yeah, he says,
phonier than a $3 bill.
Yeah, exactly. You get the sense that he, if given the opportunity, he would want to put it in their language, as he says, yeah. But doesn't take that opportunity. He is, when given a chance to write a script and maybe say something and maybe elevate these people that he kind of looks down on.
Yeah, for sure. Barton himself is as phony as a $3 bill is basically what that scene is telling us. Yeah.
And we get the Coen staple of some good Buscemi, some good early Buscemi. Oh.
But what's his character's name? I don't know. Yeah, no, I know. that sort of, when he hands the sequence is funny anyway, when he's checking into the hotel room, and then when Buscemi slides that piece of paper that just says Chet !! to him, it just really drives it home. And also just that beautiful moment in Hollywood history when there was like an 8-year period where Steve Buscemi could be in a movie and only have like 8 lines and just absolutely crush every single one of them because he's Steve Buscemi. But it's so good.
So why does Chet come up from the basement?
And why is he holding shoes? I have a lot of questions about shoes.
Well, I assume he's polishing the shoes for their complimentary shoe shining policy.
That is definitely my assumption as well. So the short answer to why is he coming up from the basement is, I don't know.
And the Coens don't know.
Yeah, exactly. And fuck you for even thinking that anybody knows.
Stupid giraffe.
Yeah, exactly. Go eat some grass or whatever giraffes eat. but there is a lot of dissension in this movie, like going down. I saw a note somewhere where that we never see the elevator moving anywhere but downwards. The opening shot where we're looking at the wallpaper during the opening credits, the camera's even slightly descending there. Our first shot post credits is that pulley sort of being pulled down, like you know the opening shot of the movie.
In the theater. Yeah.
Yeah, that sort of ends with Barton standing off stage. It's sort of a a longish oneer, and but it starts with this long shot of a pulley being pulled down on stage, like showing the mechanisms and that sorry the mechanisms of the theater and that mechanism specifically being pulled downwards,
and
just going down the drain after, during the sex sequence.
Yeah, and just that opening shot, you know, we get this really long shot of, you know, the work of a theater hand, this kind of more working class part of something of Broadway, something that's so glitzy and glamorous and involving, you know, famous stars and famous people. And then we spend most of our time in that theater watching this stagehand or this tech or whatever it would be called.
He's the fishmonger of theater.
But even that, he plays a working class guy in this play. He does it with boredom, but, you know, seems to nail it. You know, he's lowering and raising this curtain or doing whatever he's doing with that pulley there. And it's just, you know, if that sequence is 2 minutes, then a minute and a half of it is watching this guy do his work or watching that work happen. And that sequence of the film seems to be focused on the common man and the working class person, even in such a separate world that we don't think of as working class like that.
Yeah, for sure. And I think it is worth pointing out, not to make fun of you at all, but those are two different people that you've combined into one person. That's how common those people are, is that we've totally forgotten about one of them. And I will point out, I did just double check that to make sure I wasn't doing the same thing in reverse.
But yeah, so you were talking about the descent of so many of these things.
Yeah, and I think that is just... I think that's pretty much the end of my point, in that this is one of those things where we see a lot of downward motion in this movie, but I don't necessarily have a reading on it. And I guess it's sort of that Barton wants to get deeper into something. Or it's also another theme that runs all throughout the Coen's career is a bunch of religious things that I would never understand. A descent into hell, if you will. So it could be
this
something
movie
like
does
that.
Kind of end up in hell.
Yes, that one. The when the walls are on fire, that's it's pretty obvious to me. that one I can get, but yeah, I think there's always a lot of religious stuff in any Coen Brothers movie that I just don't have the knowledge base for. So maybe there's something there that I'm not seeing, but that's all I've got for Dissension. It's just either he's trying to dig deeper into something, he's trying to dig deeper into the theater or the movies for the common man, or he's descending into hell, or maybe he's doing both.
Yeah, no, I think that visual motif of things heading downward is apparent, and I think it's a good one to point out. And yeah, as I said, we do kind of end up in hell by the end of this movie, or shortly right before the end, I suppose. And just things getting worse, but Barton also states that his job is to plumb the depths of humanity or something like that. And I think as, you know, he has this thing with Charlie where, as we've stated, he kind of doesn't want to get to know him. He asks him a few questions, but he's constantly interrupting him. He's kind of just using him as someone to talk at when Charlie is sharing stories or sharing advice. You know, he's really just kind of dismissive of him as, you know, just some other guy, even though this is, as far as he knows, one of the common men that he purports to be kind of supporting or finally giving a voice to. And I think we do get deeper and deeper into knowing who Charlie is. And, you know, we kind of plumb the depths of who this person is. And we learn that, you know, he's maybe not a normal person. Maybe and I say maybe just because this movie does leave a lot of things ambiguous and we don't know. Quite what's real, maybe, but that's a kind of a particular thing about the second half of this movie. Some people think it's a dream sequence, some people think it just gets weird, however you want to look at it. But this is kind of his chance to get to know one of these people and kind of get deeper into his personality, and he kind of does so against his will. You know, he says it's something he wants to do, he doesn't take that opportunity, but he gets, you know, with the murder of Audrey and with the presence of those police officers, he kind of is getting deeper into this world, sort of, as I said, unwillingly, but undeniably.
Yeah, absolutely.
And so you mentioned the the scene of the camera going down the pipe. Did you want to talk any more about that, or do you just see that as kind of one more example of something going downward?
I think we should mention it's certainly another scene of something going downward, and it's the most obvious example. It's the way that the sound, like we start to hear people screaming as we're going down that drain. That's really intense. But yeah, I suppose I don't have anything else to, like, because I don't have a read of it. Do you?
Well, I did from a kind of a technical standpoint. Did you see anything about them doing this shot?
I mean, it's a cool shot. I think there's a notable sync shot in Blood Simple. I was wondering about that. I didn't have time to double check that, but no, I don't. Short answer is no.
Okay, I think this was.
It certainly seems difficult to do. You
know? Yeah, the director of photography said this is kind of like the one really difficult shot that that he had to do. But I think, you know, to say plumb the depths, I think this is actually an example of plumbing. And it's compared, because this is, we're supposed to understand that he and Audrey have sex at this point in the film as well. Mm-hmm. And this movie has a lot of Hitchcock parallels and homages, whatever you will. Mm-hmm. And in North by Northwest, there's that scene of the train entering the tunnel that is used as a very visual metaphor of people having sex. And this is similar to that, but it's, you know, it's just grosser, you know. Yeah. It's for lack of a better word, it's, we have this downward trajectory that we've been talking about. It's, as you said, the sound is trickier, but then it's more awful, this hotel.
It's like people screaming.
Yeah, and we could talk about more about the sounds of the Hotel Earl as well, but it doesn't seem to just be a way of saying this is people having sex and we want to communicate that in a somewhat non-disgusting way. This is, it really leans into kind of the worst parts of it, and you know, kind of just the filth of the plumbing and going down, and yeah, as you said, those sounds. And when we see the result of it, it's Audrey's pretty gruesome death. It was the result that we see. It's an interesting twist on a visual metaphor that we've kind of seen before, but done up to communicate a lot of things that come as a result of it.
Yeah, absolutely. And you mentioned the director of photography of this movie, not by name. It's Roger Deakins. It's the first time Coens and Deakins worked together, because Barry Sonnenfeld, their usual guy, had gone off to direct The Addams Family. And one quick visual thing that I'll point out is that Sonnenfeld hates pans and would never. I remember listening to an interview with him around when Men in Black 3 was coming out, and he's talking about how when he worked with the Coens, he would always be like, "No, we can't pan the camera. We're not doing pans. And so this is their first movie not with Barry Sonnenfeld. There's some pretty good pan shots in this movie. Like when it happens a couple times when Charlie is coming in too. When Charlie and Barton first meet, like the setup there, where we see from Barton's perspective, him following through, like looking at the wall as he hears Charlie coming to the front door. And then we get that again towards the end after he screams, or later on after he screams when he realizes Audrey's dead next to him. But yeah, that's an important moment in cinematography history for you. It's when the Coens were allowed to start panning their camera.
Do you want to talk more about the hotel? Which, I mean, we've kind of mentioned, but I think it has a certain visual appeal in a way that it's depicted that I think is worth mentioning too.
Yeah, it's very... I think Art Deco would be a word that, yep, I'm not wrong for using. I think the lobby really feels, particularly when Barton's walking in, there's a real, again, noir feel to it. Specifically, it reminds me of Blade Runner a little bit, which, again, was playing with all sorts of noir things from noir anyway. You know, they really crank the fog machine up to 11 for those shots. And in general, it just sort of has that that old-fashioned feel to it, which isn't wrong for the time period, but there's something sort of spooky about it as well, like especially that lobby. The lobby's so large and so empty and so dark. And it's not a place for hanging out, despite the fact that that is specifically what a lobby is designed for. Yeah. And I think that sort of is something that really, really jumps out at you, is that just how large it is and how few people you see sitting there for the entirety of the movie. It's only when Barton's meeting Chet to check in, and when he's having that conversation with the cops towards the end. And that's sort of incredibly cavernous. And then the hotel halls are very, I don't know. Again, we don't see anybody other than Charlie and Chet. So, with the exception of a lot of shoes.
Yeah, we have all the shoes out there. So you get this idea that it is populated and busy. But you never see anybody. And that's kind of, I don't want to finish talking about the hotel just yet, but that is something that you see a lot of in this movie. There are certainly crowd scenes, like the restaurant and
the soldiers.
The soldiers, but it's a pretty empty movie when you think of how, it's supposed to be a major city, and we don't see people in the hotels. The beach is pretty empty when he's there, and it just seems like the only purpose of Hollywood is for filmmaking.
Yeah.
We don't see the common people in this movie that purports to be about a man who wants to be about the common people. We don't see a ton of people just working and existing unless they have a direct role in Barton's life. And I think that's really interesting. And those restaurant scenes we see, they seem very busy, but it seems very industry. You know, Mayhew says Thor Rock in here, and
Geisler.
Yeah, Geisler says, you know, throw a rock in here and you'll hit a writer. Just do me a favor and throw it hard, which is funny. But, you know, it just seems that the only people who exist here are people who are involved in the industry and who are already rich. And I think that's an interesting way to not really populate this world with common people.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think going back to the hotel and all the shoes is that, like, we know there are people there, but they're just sort of blocking out the world, which is kind of what Barton is trying to say that he's not doing, but absolutely is. He's just another, to everybody else in that hotel, he's just another set of shoes outside the door. Like, they don't know anything about him. And as you said, with the exception of Charlie, he's not talking to any of these people. He wouldn't listen to them if they were around. He'd just keep his head down and keep him moving, you know? And I think that speaks to a sort of, there are a lot of people like Barton in this world, and we just don't see them because Barton doesn't care about them, doesn't care to meet them. He stays in his room and we stay with him.
Yeah, and there's a self-centeredness to the way that I think that he's at the center of this movie. And if we're watching it through his eyes, maybe there are people in those hallways and in that lobby, but they mean so little to him, they don't even show up on the film, right?
Yeah, yeah.
And just to speak about the hotel's color scheme a bit too, and just the look of it, it's a lot of yellows and greens and browns. It's all these sort of unhealthy body colors, you know, it's things of a bruise or pus or something. And we're reminded of that when the glue starts melting, mm-hmm. and the wallpaper starts coming down. It seems like the hotel is this living organism, but this deeply unhealthy one, or at least that its relationship with Barton is an unhealthy one. And the fact that, you know, he spends one night in there and he already looks sick, and it's, you know, he says it's just mosquito bites, but it seems as though his condition just kind of worsens throughout it. And you don't know if that's him in the hotel or he in the lobby, just kind of, they just seem like these two living creatures that can't peacefully coexist. And it manifests itself in these symptoms of, he just looks sick for so much of this movie. Once he gets there, he just looks like an unhealthy person. And, just the browns look like blood stains in the hotel. Just everything about it is just this very, it's, as I said, it gives this this feeling of being a living creature, but being an unhealthy living creature near death.
Yeah, absolutely. No, that's a good point that I didn't think about. But
yeah, and the walls, the wallpaper coming down and having to be pinned up, it speaks to kind of the facade around this place and around Hollywood in general of something that, you know, there's these thin veneers all over the place and can very easily be undone to show that things aren't quite exactly what they seem.
Yeah, no, for sure. And if you try and fix it, Chet's only going to give you like a box of thumbtacks.
Yeah.
Which, I mean, I suppose I don't know a lot about repairing wallpaper, but it feels like it's a very temporary fix at best. Yes,
I would agree. Yeah. Do you want to talk about the World War II and the fascism stuff?
I'm sure you have things to say about it. Like, again, I don't mean like, again, this comes from a place of ignorance. This is just something that you know would know more about than I would. You know, like the thing that I noticed was the dates on the clapper in the for the dailies he's watching was like a few days after Pearl Harbor. That's what I can contribute to this conversation. what's your read? What's your take on it?
Yeah, I think the most important thing is that it's proximity to America's involvement in World War II, which, as you said, is Pearl Harbor. I mean, we get some pretty explicit ones. We get the wardrobe department making a fake military costume.
So good.
Yeah, and, you know, you can look at that as a certain phoniness on the part of Hollywood to do something you know, important. He wants to be involved in this war, but he's not actually part of the military. It's pretty disrespectful to put on a fake military 100%. Costume and pretend that, like, the stolen valor of doing that is widely frowned upon by people in and out of the military. So, you know, I think that kind of speaks to some of the things we've been talking about of, you know, Barton saying he's for the common man and then interrupting one every time he gets a chance to, this idea that he's kind of supporting his country and supporting his military by putting on a costume and seemingly not doing anything properly to support them. And then, we also have the USO dance, which gives us our best illustration of what Barton thinks his contribution to the war is going to be.
This one I've got to read.
They call it 4F.
Sorry, what'd you say?
Yeah, no, but I mean, the soldiers don't seem to have the respect for his work that he feels he deserves.
Yeah,
and
how
his mind is his uniform, and that's his contribution to the war effort. And when compared to the people who are about to go get shot at, it's maybe not quite the same.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, he is in a room full of the common man, and he is yelling about how he is better than them, that he is a creator, or maybe he even says the creator. I don't know. But no matter what, he's not really coming out of that scene looking cool to me, you know?
No, absolutely not.
Yeah.
And I think the other one that's kind of on the nose, because I think that if you go looking for this stuff, you can kind of see notions of fascism and the way that the studios are run and the power that certain people feel and the way that they can talk to certain people because they're in a, you know, what could be seen as a superior position within this company. Mm-hmm. But the cops who come for him are Deutsch and Mastrianati, a German name and an Italian name. And I think that you know, just knowing the Italian and German history of fascism at this point in the world, I think is telling. And the way that they specifically talk about fake Judaism and that this is an unrestricted hotel and that's why he's allowed in here. You know, I think those are the ones where you just don't have to go digging too much to see this as a product of its sociopolitical time.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think the other one is Lou Breeze, who's John Polito's character, is we're introduced to him with Michael Lerner, whose last name is Lipnick. Jack Lipnick is his name, the studio head guy. And Lipnick is talking about how Breeze used to be either in charge of the studio or one of the people in charge of the studio, and then he's lost a power struggle and now he's a servant. Like, he's literally getting coffee for Barton Fink in that scene. And I think that's sort of a that plays to, I think, what the movie wants us to get out of Barton's arc, and it also plays into what you're describing there as far as, like, I mean, he had his country taken over, basically, his equivalent of a country, of the studio, you know, he lost his power. And just to, while we're talking about it, the way that I see him being representative of Barton by the end of it is that Barton comes to Hollywood as this powerful Broadway writer, and then by the end, he's being told that, you know, everything you write belongs to us. You're just another stooge. And that's kind of exactly what happens to Lou Breeze outside of the story of Barton. But, you know, different versions of the same thing, I think.
Yeah, no doubt. And I think that, speak of the sort of political or economic setups, the fact that it's called Capital Pictures, and I think it has something to say about capitalism as well. And it's funny, I think that when Charlie says Hail Hitler near the end, that seems to be so, like, on paper, kind of the most powerful evocation of World War II. But I think it's, I don't know, it's mostly empty. It just kind of seems like the thing to say when things are getting the worst. But I don't really know how it ties in.
Yeah, I don't either. I think there's a with the way that the hotel goes up in flames, I think there's a Auschwitz read. I think that all the shoes with no people attached to them throughout the movie, I think is could be a symbol of Auschwitz as well, or Holocaust in general. But I definitely do not have a long read on that, and I think that's a classic Coen red herring to me, you know?
Yeah, but as we said, I don't know. It's red herring kind of denotes that you're trying to throw somebody off of the proper reading, whereas that doesn't even seem to be the case here, right?
Yeah, that's true. Okay, so yeah. Misdirect, maybe.
Yeah.
I mean, I guess that's the same as a red herring. But, you know, people... No, the one person listening to this podcast understands what we're saying. I think we're okay. Yeah. It's either Joel or Ethan. I forget who our one listener is.
They go back and forth.
Yeah. They alternate episodes.
It's part of SAG rules. They have to. No, and I think that if you're going to kind of run with that idea and look at this as a film that's about the common man or about people talking about the common man, I think that the most pessimistic, I think, reading of it in those terms is that a lot of these people who were responsible for these tragedies in World War II and these atrocities performed by Nazis and performed by common soldiers who did things that you wouldn't think common men or women would be capable of, it's the common man is not necessarily this golden person that Barton Fink talks about. Even, you know, we've talked about his sort of contradictory actions on this front, but it's that the common man is capable of horrible things, and that maybe when left to their own devices, that isn't always the case, and it's the result of certain greater forces and certain people at the top who sort of bend people to their will. But if we're going to talk about the common man in World War II, I think that it has to be kind of said that there is a role that that was played by the small people, by the millions, and not just the few at the top.
Yes. Yeah. I don't disagree.
Okay.
Yeah. I don't know. I just don't have anything to add to that other than lack of disagreement. Should we talk about the picture? Like the picture in the frame?
Yeah, I think so. And go ahead. I have some things to say, but I'll let you tee this up.
Okay. I mean, it's just sort of, it's a picture of not necessarily paradise, but the idea of most hotel art is just to be blandly pleasant. You know what I mean? And that seems to be what Barton sees in it. And it just sort of seems like this sort of idealized thing that he would have in his head, not unlike a living theater about the common man, you know, like this thing that couldn't actually exist at exactly how it appears in his head or in the head of the painter, photographer. It looks like half photo, half painting at times, depending on the framing. But it just sort of seems like too idyllic to be possible. And I think that's what we're supposed to see in it. I think it also, the way that we see Barton looking at the picture is interesting as well, because it seems like half the time the camera is focused on him looking at the picture, with the focus being the picture, but at least as much of the time we're getting close-ups of him just staring at it. And I think that sort of plays into the Barton being self-absorbed thing that we're supposed to get from this movie, of just, we see his face looking at this picture more than we actually see the picture itself. And I think that we're just seeing more of him relating to this thing than we're seeing of the actual thing. And I think that's a nice little subtle way of them tying it back to self-absorption, which
yeah. And And I think, you know, you talk about his relation to it. I think he seems genuinely moved by it. And I think we're to understand it's this extremely mass-produced picture that's probably in every room of this hotel.
Oh, for sure. Yeah.
But, you know, for someone who talks about these, you know, the these unique works of art and his lofty ideals and the way that only certain things can move people emotionally or to action, it's amazing that he is this taken aback by, as you said, this kind of just bland picture that, you know, the owners of the Earl Hotel said, okay, we have 630 rooms, okay, get 630 of it. Like, it's so it just seems so general and plain and just kind of mildly optimistic and nice, and we just have several moments of him alone with this picture and everything that it represents to him being kind of contradictory to the way we imagine and hear he thinks about art.
Yeah, no, I agree, and I think, I don't know. I think we're 100% on the same page here. I think my other point about that would be tied into the last scene of the movie where we see him on the beach, where he's talking to the woman who, you know, is the eventually made to look like the woman in the picture that he's been looking at for so long. And I mean, there are differences in that. There's an umbrella in the picture that does not exist in reality, or Barton Fink's reality, whatever we're calling that last scene.
Yeah.
And so yeah, there's a difference. There's an umbrella that isn't there in reality. There's a bird that is there in reality and isn't in the picture. And I think the thing I love the most about the ending of this movie, and it's just so goddamn Coen-y, it's crazy, is the bird flying through the image and then flying off screen out of frame. So like, depending when this picture is taken, that bird is just out of the picture frame, and then it coming back, crashing down into the water.
Yeah.
Probably dead. I mean, certainly knowing the Coens, I assume it's dead. And just that sort of element of reality, literally falling into, this image of paradise that, that Barton has had in his head. And it's like, there's always something going on outside of the picture frame, and Barton is just extremely good at ignoring it despite what he wants to say to himself and to other people.
Yeah, and I think it's kind of a bit of a lucky thing with the language at the time, but movies are called pictures at this point, and so he's able to ask her, are you in pictures?
Yeah, yeah.
And, you know, he means, are you in movies? Are you an actress? And, you know, she says, don't be silly to it, but we have this meaning of pictures as motion pictures, as films, as, you know, what he's here to write. And then we also have pictures just meaning our most basic unit of language for talking about a false representation of reality.
Yeah.
And this notion of are you in pictures, you know, are you a real thing, or do you exist in both worlds? Do you stride this line that this movie spends a lot of time dealing with? And I think that we can also look at this as Barton being part of the pictures now. You know, he's not just, and not just in the sense that he's written a film, you know, he's not part of the picture in that way, or solely in that way, but just that he's part of this whole machine. And I think that he is part of the capitalism of this film creation as the films that are created by it. You know, he's kind of found his way into this system, and even if he's not on screen, he's part of pictures as, you know, as a whole.
Yeah, absolutely. And I recognize that feels like a logical ending of this podcast, but we haven't talked about Audrey at all, and I feel like we'd being real Bartons if we didn't discuss her at all, because I do think that there's a theme underlying, like, with her in this movie that I think we sort of need to discuss. Audrey, yep, is Judy Davis's character, and the quote-unquote secretary for W.P. Mayhew, who is the John Mahoney character, who is Barton declares to be the finest novelist.
Kind of William Faulkner.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. And there's... Audrey basically at one point there's an interesting scene where Mayhew was signing a copy of his book, his new book, Nebuchadnezzar. Sorry, I called it The Nebuchadnezzar because The Matrix is so deeply burned into me as a human. But
I thought that's what that was.
Yeah, lacking the preposition, just Nebuchadnezzar. And she describes it as, you should really read this. It's I think it's one of his finest works, which is kind of how Barton describes the screenplay he hands in at the end. And we don't know this at the time, but it turns out that Audrey basically wrote Nebuchadnezzar and has been as a result of almost called him Faulkner, Mayhew's alcoholism, she has sort of taken over the writing and the writing of his work, the writing of his screenplays, the writing of his books. And I think that given where women were in 1941, I think it needs to be pointed out that, like, Mayhew is literally putting his name on her work and taking the credit for it. And I just, yeah, just needs to be pointed out because she's the common woman who is also totally ignored throughout this movie and almost in this podcast, you know?
Yeah, no, I think that's a good point. So what do you make of her fate then?
I don't know. This is actually the first time I'm thinking. I know that it doesn't sit well with me. Like, that's another noir thing that is just like the mall has to die sort of thing.
Yeah, she shows a bit of agency and.
Yeah, exactly. So, like, I don't have a strong reading of it other than I suppose she's used by the world so much that nobody seems to miss her when she's gone. I don't know. Like, her arc in general is incredibly dark in a way. Like, the movie does not pay a lot of attention to it. And I think that's kind of the point. But she has an incredibly dark arc, you know?
Yes, 100%.
But I do love her proto Cate Blanchett voice that she does. Like, if this had been a Coen Brothers movie made today, Audrey is played by Cate Blanchett and sounds exactly the same.
Okay. That's, so maybe.
There you go.
Well, but you won't get her in the talked about Barton Fink sequel.
Has there been a talked about Barton Fink sequel?
Yeah.
Is it just him sitting on the beach for another few hours watching birds crash into the water?
No, it's him in the 70s.
Really?
Yeah, I don't think it's going to happen, but no, you can see John Turturro and the Coens talk about it separately.
Wow, that's interesting.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I'll be thinking about that for the rest of the week.
The term Jufro is in the synopsis, so.
Doesn't surprise me. That sounds like something the three of them would come up with. But yeah, thanks for listening to The MacGuffin Man. Be sure to check back whenever we post a new podcast.